Hey there. Welcome to one of our first stories of the podcast. I'm David All, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. In season three, we shouldered up with you and made it clear that this podcast is not for sale. No advertising or outside influence, a sacred and safe space. Starting with season three, we dedicate a poem to one of our listeners that is standing with us as an enabler of our mission. They're doing so by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. To be true to our word, we're going back through some of our earlier content in seasons one and two and removing the segments that we feel may not be congruent with this idea. So enjoy. This story, like every other story on our podcast, is now 100% advertising free. A safe space where you can let your guard down, listen, and notice if something comes up in your soul. If you would like to be an enabler, and we certainly could use your help, visit bellystory.com and chip in $5 today. Now, here's that extraordinary life story.
You know, I think it's true of most people. It's probably true of more so of most physicians. We find ourselves on the dull side of the needle. And so now to be placed in the position where I'm the patient really took a little bit of a mindset change.
This podcast is about the time we all get knocked down in life and climb up a new person. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts. Let me introduce you to Dr. Julian Gold. I first met Dr. Gold when he was mayor of Beverly Hills and the founder of Next Beverly Hills, a group of next-gen leaders. Dr. Gold is a two-time mayor of Beverly Hills and a current city council member. But beyond his public life, Dr. Gold has practiced medicine as an anesthesiologist for more than three decades, and was not only chair of his department, but also a member of the board of directors at Cedars-Sinai here in Los Angeles. When I told Dr. Gold about this podcast, he opened up about his story battling cancer. Dr. Julian Gold, welcome to Belly of the Beast Life Stories.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here with you today and honored that you would want to tell my story, so thank you.
Dr. Gold, take us back to that time in your life when a diagnosis changed everything.
In 2006, I was practicing, and I was managing my anesthesia group, and things were busy. Life was good. I was serving on the Traffic and Parking Commission for the City of Beverly Hills. I was a member of the Cedars-Sinai Board of Directors. The anesthesia group was going very well, and life was normal. There was a Sunday morning. Actually, what happened, it started a little bit before that. I hurt my leg. I actually hurt the back part of my heel, and it was not getting better. It was just very painful. So I talked to my orthopedic friend, and he prescribed one of these horrible boots where you can't move your foot very much. And he told me to take some, it's called Naprosyn. It's a very strong Advil. And I did. And much as I hated the boot, you know, I did what I had to do. Sunday morning, I woke up and I was drenched. I had what we call night sweats. The bed was soaked. I was soaked. I didn't have any recollection of this happening in the course of the night, but it was like I had jumped in the swimming pool. I don't know. I didn't think too much about it. It was unusual. And I decided Monday morning I would go see my internist. My internist, who was a friend, kind of took a look at me, and he said, well, who knows what this is? Probably not much. Let's get some blood work done, and we'll figure it out. So he took the blood work, and he said, I'll call you when I get it. And he actually did the blood work in his office. Half hour later, he called me back, and he said, you know, I think you ought to come back here. I need to talk to you. So that obviously was not a good sign. A normal white blood count is, depending on the laboratory, up to 12,000 white cells per whatever they measure. Mine was 55,000. And along with that, it was skewed in a way that really did point to the diagnosis without proving it. So it didn't take much to figure out that if this was real, and there was no reason to think that it wasn't, that this was leukemia. But he sent me to an oncologist, hematologist oncologist, also somebody I had worked with and knew well, and he did a bone marrow biopsy that afternoon. So this is now Monday afternoon. And took a quick look at the slide, and it pretty much confirmed what we both knew to be true, which was I had this acute myeloid leukemia. Not a good diagnosis. One of the things I would advise everybody, and I actually do advise everybody, is if you get a diagnosis, any diagnosis, avoid the internet. It's not going to make you feel better. It'll likely make you feel worse. And it's as much a source of bad information or misinformation as it is good information.
You know, that was actually going to be my first follow-up question, is whether or not you turned to the internet and did a search.
I did for the first two or three, and then I said, this is nonsense. I'm done with this.
And specifically, when you mean nonsense, do you mean it's not factual information?
Well, it's all over the map. Some of it was factual. Much of it was old. The detail was missing in many places. It turned out that the real information was much deeper, denser, and important than the sort of the superficial observation of what's on the internet. And it was the kind of thing that, that's why there are experts, that's why you go talk to the experts, but it also, as a patient now, one of the hard things as a doctor is to be a patient. And so now I'm a patient, and I sort of need to educate myself as a patient about what's going on with me. And this took some time. This actually took us some time to understand all of the elements of what was going on. And it was not just me. It was my wife, too. She was my advocate through all of this and my staunchest supporter always. So I abandoned the internet pretty quickly, and I decided, listen, I know the experts. I'm going to talk to the experts and let them tell me what I need to know. That was one critical decision. The other critical decision as a physician was to come to the hard and fast rule that I was the patient. I wasn't the doctor, and I didn't want to behave like a doctor. For this, I needed to behave like a patient. And that's what I did. So now I had a diagnosis. I had gone to see the oncologist. He told me pretty much what was true. He also told me that time was of the essence here and that he didn't want to waste any time treating me, that I needed to kind of get myself in the hospital in the next couple of days. So I called my wife and I said, you know, I think you need to come home. I need to talk to you, which she did. She knew it wasn't good news, but, you know, I didn't really want to do this on the phone. And then after that, my daughter and my parents were alive and some of our close friends, and we spent that Monday and most of Tuesday just telling people and kind of putting things in order so that the normal course of family life could kind of continue. The bills had to get paid. I was the one who did that. I sort of had to show my wife what that looked like. How do you do it on the computer and where are the checks and all that kind of stuff. And Wednesday I went in the hospital and I began the therapy, and that was difficult. The whole thing was difficult, but the therapies were pretty intense.
You've described some of the physical complications, let's say, of getting diagnosed and having to go into the hospital right away. Can you delve into the emotional effects?
You know, I think it's true of most people. It's probably true of more so of most physicians. We find ourselves on the dull side of the needle. And so now to be placed in the position where I'm the patient really took a little bit of a mindset change. You know, and knowing a little knowledge being dangerous, you know, that first series of kind of emotions and thoughts is, this is really bad. You know, this is a bad thing. And your mind sort of jumps to, what is the worst case? You know, am I going to be here for my daughter's graduation from high school? Am I ever going to see her get married and have kids and all that kind of stuff? You know, I never actually thought I'd predecease my parents, but I guess that's a possibility. You know, how do you come to terms with all of that? You know, I was 56 at the time, and at 56, although certainly doing what we do, we recognize that mortality is a possibility. We don't really think that it's a likely possibility. And so sort of coming to terms with all of that. And that was tough. That was really, really hard. And, you know, and then you get on the, you go back to the internet piece and that little cursory, examination of the data on the internet talked about, you know, 40 and 50% mortality. And with the stem cell transplant, when we ultimately came to talk about that, but even on the internet, we talk about 10% mortality in the first 100 days of treatment. So these were pretty staggering numbers. These were, there are not a lot of diseases out there where you take a look at 40 and 50% mortalities. Now, as it turns out, that most of that was older information, and the overall mortality rate is really not that high. But nonetheless, it's substantial. It's not zero by any means. And so just sort of coming to terms with that, having to recognize that we're talking about me and not somebody else. And, you know, that was tough. That was really, really tough.
Do you remember a specific moment that it just sort of caught up to you?
Over the course of that Tuesday, I think Monday afternoon and evening, we were all pretty numb. Tuesday, as we were sort of making some of these arrangements and things, I guess we had some time to kind of mull over what this all meant. And I think somewhere there on Tuesday, this recollection that this is beyond serious. This is, you know, potentially fatal became real.
Hmm. What about your colleagues? Were people reaching out to you?
Yeah, you know, my colleagues fell into a couple of categories. My close friends, colleagues, obviously gathered close and, you know, whatever we can do. And that, I think some of them were, it was awkward. You know, I think that for some people, it was hard for them to get close. And I understood that. I understood that, you know, they had seen me in one context, it's a different context. I think some people just felt that this was a complicated time and they didn't want to intrude. You know, they felt that if I wanted to reach out, they were there, but they were not going to intrude. It was kind of all over the map. For the most part, my colleagues were wonderful. They were very helpful and very supportive and did all kinds of stuff. I have to say that amongst the things, and one of the reasons I ultimately ran for city council, and I've said this, is the community at large. That's not just the medical community, but the Beverly Hills community were wonderful. They, in all kinds of different ways, stepped up to support not only me, but my family. My daughter was in high school at the time. She was 16. It was a particularly difficult thing for her. her friends, she was on a soccer team and a softball team, and her friends and her and their parents would make sure she was always taken care of. She needed a ride someplace. There was always somebody around to do that. You know, just sometimes just to take her out for an ice cream and try and cheer her up. The community came together. We had one of the surgeons I know, a lovely lady, actually made me this enormous pot of soup. You know, just did it. From scratch.
That's old-fashioned
medicine. Old-fashioned, you know, chicken soup, you know, and maybe that's why I got better. I always kidded her about the fact that the chicken soup worked. But people did all kinds of stuff like that, and usually not, almost never for having been asked to do it, but just because it was the right thing to do or they felt they wanted to do it, they were being helpful. And so the community really came together in support of us, and that felt good. That was, for as bad as all the rest was, that part really, really made us feel good.
So it's Wednesday, and you're now a patient in your hospital.
Right.
And you're wearing a patient outfit, I imagine.
Yeah, of course.
And so you don't have your coat on, your doctor's coat.
Right.
Do you feel like lack of dignity or, you know, how do you feel?
I don't have any real recollection of that time. Actually, when I was there, they let you put on, like, hospital pants. You didn't have to wear the gown with your butt flapping in the air. So you didn't have to do that. And I could, you know, I had a T-shirt and a pair of pants on. So I guess I felt dressed and made it a little bit. I'll tell you a funny story, though. So they started the chemo. It was very intense chemo. And it was one of the things that amazed me through the course of all of this was the precision with which the nurses manage this. You have five or six different things running in at different rates on these machines that beep and make all kinds of noises and things. And you need to be precise in the timing of all of this and how the whole thing happens. And the nurses were spectacular. They just got it right every time, you know, and they just kept the meds moving and the whole thing moving. But that first day when they started the medication regime, I didn't feel all that badly. You know, I was anticipating feeling terrible from the chemo, but I actually didn't. This chemo is pretty rough chemo. The idea of this chemo is essentially to wipe out all your blood cells. The idea is to get the bone marrow where it starts to reproduce cells. And so they give you this very toxic chemotherapy. It's the first part of this whole thing. And so I was anticipating feeling terrible. I actually didn't feel that bad physically, you know. At the same time, the hospital was being very nice. They had brought me the sort of the super duper menu. And I decided, you know, I was feeling good. I might as well eat, you know, so I had a decent dinner that first night.
So take me back to the chemo, because you just described something that could be very scary to people, which is like the most toxic chemotherapy that there is that wipes out all blood cells. But you just said that it wasn't that bad for you.
Well, we'll get to that. because I was feeling pretty good, and I ordered my breakfast for now what was going to be my third day in the hospital, and I did order the breakfast burrito. I got sicker than a dog. I really did. And this was the beginning of the impact of the chemo, but it just so happened that that day they, you know, hospitals like to measure customer satisfaction, and that day was the day that I got the customer satisfaction thing from the kitchen. And I just wrote back on it, you know, the chemo's not so bad, but the burrito almost killed me. You have to have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You have to have a sense of humor, you know. And that was the beginning of not feeling so good, you know. I was in the hospital almost a month with that first round of chemo. And what happens is, your blood count falls and falls and falls. It's interesting when all the white blood cells go away, you actually feel bad. And I don't think anybody knows why. But when they start to come back, because then they stop the chemo and they stop the chemo once the cells are all gone. And so once they do that, the bone marrow starts again and you start to make cells. And when the white cells started to come back, I could almost predict. I learned to predict when they were coming back just because I felt better. And sure enough, they did. So your cells come back, and I was fortunate that in this first round of chemo, the leukemia cells went away. I was in remission. There was no guarantee that that was going to be true. And if it hadn't been true, we would have done the same thing all over again to try and put me in remission. Some people react and go into remission quickly. I was fortunate to be one of those. Others, not so much. And they may need a second round of chemo to get them, or a third round of chemo to get them into remission, sometimes with some fiddling with the chemo. After about a month, and now having my cells back, I got to go home for a couple of weeks, and then came back in the hospital to do it all over again, because the way the regime works is once you go into remission, they bring you back, or at least they did then. I don't know if they still do, because it's been 12 years, but they bring you back to do it again, and just to make sure that all the bad cells are gone. And so you go through a second round of chemo and pretty much the same drill as the time before. And actually I should say between the two, I did get some opinions about what to do next. There weren't a whole lot of discussion about options. It was pretty clear that the oncologists were recommending stem cell transplant. But, you know, it was worth getting opinions. And so we did travel a little bit. My wife was crazed over the thought that I was going to get some sort of bad bug, some sort of cold or something. So we were quite the scene on the airplane between the thing that covered the seat and the mask I wore on my face. And I could have been in a bubble hood kind of thing, but ultimately we decided that the thing to do was stem cell transplant. Stem cell transplant's its own thing.
So this is after the third round?
Second. This is the second round, and after the second round, I was still in remission. Okay. I did the remission round, wow, the consolidation round, and then we were now ready for stem cell.
Okay.
So there's a large registry, millions of people in the stem cell registry. I encourage everybody to get tested. It's called Be the Match is one of them. There are a number of programs where they'll take your stem cell. They'll swab you. All they do is swab you, your cheek, in order to get some of your DNA. And it goes into this huge, huge database. And then when people need it, they take six specific chromosomes, specific genes, and they try and match it against this huge database. Fortunately, Eastern European origins, my grandparents, and it turns out that in this database, which is international, it's not just the United States, but the Eastern European ethnicities are particularly well represented. It makes getting a match much easier for people of that ethnicity as compared to Hispanic or African-American, even Chinese and things like that. Those ethnicities are just not as well represented. So it turned out that there's a whole process by which they match your chromosomes against your DNA against others. And from that, the oncologist makes a decision to further test some other number, and from that picks one, and in that further testing, they actually have to ask that person for more blood, and they test that the blood against you in terms of how they make a match. Generally, they prefer younger people to older people, and they prefer men to women because women tend to have more antibodies, antigens and antibodies, especially women who've been pregnant. And so it's easier to find a good match from young guys than it is from any other category.
So how long did it take to find a match?
We were pretty lucky. I got diagnosed in September. We did a month of chemo, separated by a couple of weeks of recovery, by the next 3 weeks of chemo, another couple of weeks of recovery. And we did this, actually, I got the stem cells on the 28th of December that year. I started the process at the City Hall probably 2 weeks before that. There was stuff that had to happen. I wasn't in the hospital at that time, but we would go out there and a couple of things that had to happen in advance of that. And I actually went into the hospital on the 24th of December, 2006. I was fortunate that we found a really good match. The match process is intriguing. It's anonymous. So the donor, neither the donor nor the recipient know each other in the beginning. After a year, both have the opportunity to decide if they want to meet the other. So, but in that year, you can sort of communicate. And my wife was very good at, this is now after the stem cell is done and the whole thing, we go home, but kind of getting to the end before the beginning. My wife was very good at communicating with the donor. The irony was that a year later, we got to meet him, and he could have come from anywhere in the world. And we had visions of this little igloo with my stem cells going around in the airport and waiting for somebody to pick him up. But it turned out that he lived in Westlake Village, and he—
Very near to Los Angeles.
Very near, 15 miles, 20 miles. And he had actually donated the stem cells at the City of Hope. And the story is that the amount of stem cells you need is based on how big you are. And in his first donation of stem cells, it was not enough for somebody of my size. So he had to come back for a second session, which happened to fall on the day they were going to bury his grandmother. And some conversation in that household about what are we going to do about burying grandma. And it turns out that all of his family said, listen, you go give the stem cells. We'll take care of grandma. And, you know, it was obviously a good thing for me. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful that grandma understood.
So I'd love to hear from you how important the community was for you to start your recovery process.
Right. We touched on this a little before. You know, you have a lot of time sitting in a hospital room getting chemotherapy. You have a lot of time to think. And, you know, you have all these things that you normally would have done that you can't do because you're here. All of the things that, you know, my daughter needed help with her homework, my wife was working at the time and taking care of my daughter and commuting to the City of Hope. It was a lot. It was just a lot going on in our lives. And you know, one of the things that's really important, independent of the patient, is actually the patient's family, the caregivers. You know, one of the things we've learned over the course of time is that you really have to take care of the caregivers. Because they're doing all this stuff and they're taking care of the patient and, you know, who's there, where is their emotional support? How do they get helped? And that was particularly true of my wife and my daughter. And really that's, I think, where the community shown the best. I was being cared for by doctors and nurses and all that. And certainly people came in and helped and cheered me up and brought me stuff and all that. And I really appreciated that. But it was when my wife had to go home, you know, or was there somebody there to take her out and have dinner with her? Or when my daughter needed help with her homework or a ride someplace. This was where we really saw the strength of community and where her friends and my wife's friends and my friends kind of came together in support and more than emotional support, in real practical support for things, you know. Do you need us to take the dry cleaning in? Do you need us to, you know, whatever? And I have to say that at the time we were known in the community, but, you know, I hadn't run for office. We were not prominent, as it were, in the community. We had a wonderful group of friends, and it just seemed to expand. There were people that I didn't know that well who made it their business to show up and say hi regularly. Just how you feeling? What's going on? What can we do for you? It really made you feel good. That made me feel good and was very helpful for my family that the community came together like that in support.
The idea of the belly of the beast is, of course, the story of getting snatched by the giant fish and taking all the way to the bottom of the ocean and being inside that belly,
right,
and fully surrendering once you're there. So when you were in the hospital for weeks on end, you just said that you had a lot of time. I mean, what were you thinking about?
I had a lot of time to, I made a very conscious decision. I could spend time with the "woe is me" piece of this. This is really lousy. I was fine one day and I was really sick the next. And this was really like getting struck by lightning, and it didn't make any sense, and it certainly wasn't fair. And I could have made a big deal about all of that, but at the end of the day, I recognized that that was not going to serve me well. So I made up my mind that for all of the bad statistics, you know, the 40% mortalities or the 10% mortality in 10 days after the stem cells or any of that, or 100 days, 10% in 100 days mortality after the stem cell transplant, all that, I just never thought that was going to be me. You know, maybe that's denial, but for me, I just made up my mind, okay, there's a little bit of a wrong turn, and we have to recalibrate. We're just going to have to get back on the right path here. And I'm going to trust the doctors to do what they have to do. And for myself, I have to stay positive. And I made some rules for myself. So I made a rule that said, no matter how bad I felt, no matter how bad today was, I was not going to spend all of today in bed. Going to get myself up and out of bed, sitting in a chair, you know, and just not lying there. I made a rule that said every day I was going to take a shower and change my clothes and just feel better about me. And I made a rule that said I'm going to exercise a little bit, as much as I can. And if that meant walking around my hospital room, it would be that. And when I was a little bit more able, I would prance out in the hall and I would walk around the halls of the hospital. But I decided that I needed those sorts of positive experiences in order to keep me positive and keep me focused on getting better. In the midst of it all, for the couple of times I was at Cedars, people would come in and I would think I would be talking business. I think most of them thought I was talking nonsense. But I would try and engage in the what I thought was the regular business, the ongoing business of my medical group in the hospital, and sort of staying engaged and staying connected and not losing touch, not feeling that I was isolated, not feeling that I was irrelevant, you know. All of that was really important to me, even if the people I was talking to kind of figured, well, okay, you know, we're just talking to them. But all of that was really important for me to, I think it made me feel like that although I had this bad illness, I still had a big piece of my life as I knew it was intact. And if I could sort of hold on to that, we would get over this and kind of get back to the way it was. And I found that to be helpful for me. Routine became important, and routine that sort of reproduced in some way what had been my normal life was really important. And I found strength in that. I think I probably read a couple of books. I can't tell you what. And, you know, Michelle kept the journal. My wife kept the journal day to day, mostly detail about what was going on, what the drugs were and all this kind of stuff. But nonetheless, we had a written record of that time. But those were the things that kept me optimistic and positive. And I think in the end contributed to, you know, how well I did. That and a whole lot of luck and some really good doctors and nurses.
So when did you feel like you were back on your feet?
Yeah, I got out of the hospital in January. It was the start in September. So the stem cell process was over early January. And for the first little bit after they let me out of the hospital, I had to go back to the City of Hope every day, every other day. It got further and further apart over time. I would say there's a thing where once you have this, you cannot, they put you on something called a neutropenic diet, which means it has to be really clean. It can't be, you can't eat fruit, you can't eat vegetables unless they're boiled. Meats and things like that get incinerated. They have to be cooked so much. And so you're on a very restricted diet for a while until your immune system adjusts and all this kind of stuff. So that probably lasted for the first 100 days. That 100 days is really critical in this stem cell business. And maybe a little bit longer than that. So that's, what, 4 months. And after that, you can begin to get back to a more normal diet. I went back to work when they said I could, which was probably after the 100 days. But I was bald. A guy with a lot of hair was bald. You know, I'd obviously lost some weight. I looked like crap, you know. And in the early stages of it, I was still wearing a mask so that I was exposed. And I would sort of sit in some of these meetings that I had sat in for years, but obviously looking very different and, you know, everybody kind of looking at me. It was a little weird. But, you know, my hair grew back and it didn't change color. And I would say by the time I was 6 months done, 6 months post-transplant, I felt okay, and it probably took me another 6 months, so probably almost a year, before I could say, I think I'm back to where I was. It took a while. It was tough. It was tough in a lot of different ways. It was tough physically, and it was tough emotionally. It was, even now, so it's 12 years later, I think the statistics say I'm past the point of danger for this. But twice a year I go back for, they look at me and pat me on the head and draw some blood. And that's always nerve-wracking just to know that the blood counts are okay and that's this far out. So I don't think it ever goes away. I don't think that fear, anxiety, maybe a better word, I don't think it ever really goes away. It doesn't interfere in my day-to-day life, but it's always in the background. I'll tell you a funny story so now I'm home and I'm better and Michelle and I are talking about, you know, where are we and how are things and all this. And, you know, we had this different perspective because up until the time I got sick, we dealt with the normal things that people get aggravated about. And we sort of said, well, okay, so now we know the really things to get aggravated about. Maybe we don't sweat the small stuff, right? Okay. And so we said we were going to do that. All right, we're going to not sweat the small stuff. And that lasted for a while. I have to say that it created a perspective for a while. But over time, as our day-to-day got more normal, all of a sudden the small stuff would intrude. And Michelle said to me one day, she said, I thought we said we're not going to sweat the small stuff. Why are we dealing with this? And I thought about it, and I realized that a strange transition had happened. When we had the big stuff to worry about, the small stuff didn't matter. But the fact that now we could worry about the small stuff meant that we didn't have the big stuff to worry about. So maybe it was a blessing. Maybe sweating the small stuff was actually an indication of normalcy. And the fact that we can now reestablish what had been sort of our life before, and maybe in itself was a transition back to, you know, the completion of recovery, if you will. So it's interesting how your mindset changes as there's distance between the time things happen and whatever comes next.
Dr. Gold, you said one of the hardest things for a doctor is to be a patient.
That's correct.
And I'd love for you to turn that around and be the doctor. And, you know, someone's just now diagnosed or going through this, or a family is going through what you went through. What do you say to them?
Well, I think you have to be honest. I mean, I don't think you can ignore the realities of what is a difficult diagnosis. But I think you have to do a couple of things. You have to, A, be positive. And in the course of my life since my therapy, my diagnosis and therapy, I've spent time with patients and their families talking about this diagnosis and some of the detail around what it takes to get through the chemo and the stem cell and such. But more important than any of that is I sort of become a model for where you can be, that you can have this disease, you can get through these difficult therapies and treatments, and at the end of the day, you can look healthy and be healthy and reestablish your life. So I think the first thing when you talk to people is to say, take a deep breath here. This is not good, but, you know, it can and will likely have a good outcome. The second thing I think is very important to say to people, which I think gets lost in this, is there are good days and there are bad days. And in the course of a complicated therapy, you just have to know that there are going to be days that are going to be really tough. And there'll be setbacks, you know, where you think, you know, you're fully on the road to getting it right. Now all of a sudden something happens. There's a lab test that's abnormal. You're just not feeling good. Whatever it is, there will be 100%. There will be days that are not good days, and you just have to take them in stride. As optimistic, as good as you feel when you get good news, you know, you need to temper it and know that, you know, there are going to be days that just are not that. And I think people sometimes don't hear that. They assume that it's a straight course. You know, if it's getting better, it's going to be better. And if it's not, it's not. But it's not that. It's not a straight line. These recoveries are not straight lines. And so you just have to expect good and bad days. So I think that's important to know. I think that you have to expect honesty from your physicians, even if it's something you don't want to hear. And so every once in a while, somebody tries to argue the point, well, it's not that, you know. I think you have to, you have to have faith in the, you have to be your own advocate. You have to ask questions. But at the end of the day, you have to pick a good doctor and you have to trust their judgment to do what's right for you. And you can't negotiate treatment. I think negotiating treatment's a bad idea. So somebody comes to you and says, well, I think we need to do this. And you say, well, I'd rather you do something else. Or I read on the internet you ought to be doing something else. Or my buddy told me you should be doing something else. The reason you went to that doctor in the first place was because he had a good reputation, he had good results for this disease, and you trusted him to do, him or her, to do whatever it took to get you well. Don't change it up. This physician has a way that they do things that gets that result. And if you decide you're going to mess with it, then you don't know that you're going to get that result. So make up your mind. Understand what he or she is telling you. Understand why the doctor wants to do what the doctor wants to do. And certainly advocate for yourself. But there's no reason to change a course of therapy that has proven successful many times before because somebody tells you something different. I would be very, very careful with that.
And what would you say to the spouse or to the family members?
So the spouse, the conversation with the spouse and the family members, and I've had this a lot, is we talked about it a little bit before. You need to be mindful. You have to take care of the caregiver. The spouse, you see spouses who, and my wife wanted to do this too, I have to say, who decide that they're going to live in the room with the patient, that they're kind of going to move in. They're going to, and, you know, maybe occasionally that's okay, but, I mean, for an occasional day. But you can't burn out the caregiver. You can't burn out the spouse. You can't burn out the kids because they become ineffective and it just has a terrible impact on their life. It's okay, and I would say this, it's okay. Listen, if you want to go shopping, go shopping. You want to have dinner with some friends, go have dinner with friends. Even if it's a distraction, get out of here. Get out of here. You've been sitting here for 10 hours. You know, I don't have anything else to say to you, you know? You know, and you don't have to watch TV with me. You don't have to watch me fall asleep. And, you know, really, go. It is okay.
Do you think there's a fear of people don't want to leave someone alone?
Well, there may be some of that. And if that's really true, I guess you can alternate caregivers. And some people do that. And some families do that. I don't think that, you know, if you go out for a couple of hours or even overnight, you know, I don't think, what are you going to do? I mean, really, I think that the ability of the caregiver to do much other than call for help.
But you found some benefit in solitude.
Well, I needed time to myself. I needed, the nights were tough sometimes. I had some music that I would put on that would put me to sleep some of the time. Hospitals are strange places in that, especially when you're getting this round-the-clock therapy where nurses come in and out and change out the bottles, even if it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the bags of chemo. So getting a good night's sleep is a hard thing to do. And sometimes if you have a number of those, you begin to, the reality and that dream state sort of merge and you have almost hallucinations. You begin to get a little goofy about what really is going on. But having somebody in the room, a family member in the room with you, I don't think that helps that at all. I think that that's more based in your physiology than anything.
And what did you gain from this experience?
Well, I think I got stronger for it. I think I certainly had a better appreciation of what it was to be a patient, you know, on the now on the sharp side of the needle. I certainly did that. I think that it does change your perspective of the world, and you recognize that there are a lot of little things that irk us, but at the end of the day, they're not really important. Mostly, I grew a greater appreciation. I think I always had it, but I grew a greater appreciation for the strength and for the benefits of both community and family. And, you know, I think it makes those bonds much stronger. And I think that those are important lessons. And in the end, I think that I probably developed a greater sense of gratitude and a notion that it's important to give back, that that sort of support that comes from the community and comes from family is something that you pay forward, that you need to participate so that others in similar circumstances get that same sort of support. And hopefully when they recover, they'll do the same. So I think that this is something that's perpetuates itself. And I think it's a good thing. And I think it's something that brings communities together and makes them stronger.
Did you feel like you wanted to dive in deeper with medicine and stay even more involved and do more things around that community? Or were you pulled to do other things?
No, I don't think that it changed my view of the practice of medicine. I think, you know, I'd been pretty committed to the practice of medicine then. I'd been in practice probably for 25 years at the time. So I don't know that it changed the way I viewed the practice of medicine. I think I did get a better appreciation for the work that some of the doctors I didn't know so well did. But for me, it did actually increase my sense of community and the notion when I finally decided, and I gave a lot of thought to whether I was going to run the first time, it was 2010. And a lot of what pushed me to do that was this sense of community and that this is important and that I really wanted to participate and I wanted to give back. And that drove me in my decision-making back then to run for the city council.
Are you a survivor?
Boy, that's a tough word. I've thought about that. The, you know, the City of Hope actually has a survivor's picnic every spring. And I was having a hard time with that word. I was really having a hard time with that word. And I try to understand why I had an emotional reaction to it. I think that the reason for the reaction is that it actually brings back clearly the understanding that I might not have been. It's really a reflection of mortality. And to say that I'm a survivor, obviously to say I'm here, it still makes my hair stand on edge. But I think what it really is the implicit understanding that it didn't necessarily have to be that way. And oh, by the way, there are a whole lot of people who are not. And so, and you know, the other thing as I reflect on it is on some level, there's a little bit of guilt as a survivor, that you did make it and others did not. And so it's a loaded word. It's a very difficult word. Not one I particularly like. I mean, I like being a survivor, I suppose. But the word itself is one that just kind of gives me some angst.
Dr. Gold, thank you so much for sharing the story.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity.
What an extraordinary life story. If this story moved you, help enable our mission and keep this advertising-free podcast going by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. I'm responsible and accountable for this podcast, but I don't do it alone. Milos Brochetta is our sound engineer. Artie Wu is our advisor, and many others have helped along the way to bring the story to life. Thank you for listening. I'm David Aul, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. Thank you for rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts and sharing it with a friend or two. Stay tuned. I'm working on some stories that you need to hear.